Hello, and welcome to episode 666 of For the Love of a Franchise, the podcast where we take a look at some of those great solo films that sold their soul for a sequel or three. This month, we're looking at the, taking a spiritual route, I should say, as we look back at the Omen franchise. Well, certainly 3.5 of the franchise anyway, maybe. joining me as always are my fellow acolytes, Paul.
Hello.
All right.
Yeah, and all Josh. Good.
Evening.
Yeah. I don't know, is that acolytes or is that sort of fighters of evil? We'll decide by the end of the fourth one, I expect. we're jumping back into the 70s. We've been in the 70s quite a bit before recently on our other podcast, haven't we?
I think as well that was kind of the era where franchises kind of started as well.
Yeah, I mean, Bond, really Bond been a side, lot. Which had been sort of clapping them up before that. Bond aside, these are probably, the mid-70s is probably where you got this, you got Jaws, Star Wars, Star Trek at the last year or two of the 70s. So, yes, so you're right. It probably was kind of the decade that kicked off our podcast almost in some way.
Yeah, very much so.
So I was going to say, I thought I'd pick this one, and it's turned out to be quite good to do it this time of the year now as we'll fall into the autumn period. So so you'll have me steering the ship now as we don't go through the dark nights of autumn. Dark nights is from that we'll probably do at some other point. And we'll get back to those at some point. I think what we'll do is just jump around the film a bit and just have some chats about it and thoughts on it. I think Josh, this wasn't a first time watch for you, was it?
No, I was saying to Paul before we started recording, actually, I've got I literally finished watching this film about 13 minutes before we started recording. you know what I'm like. I like watching it the day of a record. I don't really do all the notes and that stuff. I like winging it, as many of my uni tutors will probably attest to. the thing is, I was saying to Paul before we start recording, by the way, if my voice sounds weird, I'm eating a packet of cornflakes at the same time. I don't ask why, I just am. This is a rewatch for me, but only in the sense of the plot. Now, when I say that, I think I've actually only seen, in terms of the first one, I've only seen the remake, because as I said to Paul, I remember the plot and I finished the film and I went, yeah, I remember all of that, but I don't remember any of them actors doing it.
Interesting. So you think you've seen the story, but not necessarily this version.
Yeah, basically. Mm. But the thing is, I remember the actor who played Damien, because you just can't not, because he's been made memes of like for eternity. I vaguely recall Gregory Peck, and I knew that Patrick Troughton and David Warner were in it.
Yeah.
Like, because you can't not know that they're in this film before you come to watch it. And I vaguely recall the scene of Patrick Troughton and Gregory Peck in the park before Patrick Troughton's killed. But the thing that makes me think I've only seen the remake is because all of David Warner's scenes, I only remember David Thewlis doing.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, well, yeah. I suppose we should say at this point that as I say 3.5, because the plan is we've done this one and we're going to jump forward to the remake for next month, because that'll be an interesting straight comparison then.
Yeah.
And then we'll go back to do the 2 and 3 after that. There is a TV movie sequel that got a release here, which we're not going to bother doing because apparently it's rubbish.
Well, not only that, you good fucking luck finding it.
Annoyingly, it did come up on Sky the other week. I did notice.
Oh, give off, it didn't, is it?
Yeah, it's floating around on the Sky channels.
Fucking hell, I'm going to have to try and find that then, see how shite it really
is. And also, it's quite timely just to bring it at this point. There's actually a prequel coming.
Oh, for God's sake, why does... Right, this is a problem that I am starting to have with a lot of Hollywood nowadays. Right. Has anyone seen the new series of Animaniacs?
No, I haven't watched it in a long time.
Is anyone at least aware of the song that they did called Reboot It?
No.
Right. When we finish recording this, get on Spotify, get on Amazon Music, whatever the hell it is that you use, YouTube it if you have to, and find that song and just listen to it. And that sums up my current problem with Hollywood. They make sequels out of anything and everything, which, in fairness, we'd be out of a job doing this podcast if they didn't.
Yeah.
So I'll give them that. But if they then run out of ideas, they go and make a prequel, and the prequels are always shit. Save Star Wars to a certain point of view.
And of course, now we've also got TV as well. We're getting, because this had a short-lived sort of TV show, Damien, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I have heard of this.
And other things, I think The Exorcist had a spin-off TV show a couple of years ago, which is actually quite decent. So, so there always seem to be ways of sort of trying to plug the gaps, aren't they, in these franchises like this? So there's a prequel on the way. I don't know much more about it at this point, but other than, well, I thought this was the first time he's come to Earth.
Exactly. If you want a prequel or like a sort of semi spin-off, go and watch Good Omens, which I would highly recommend because it's a fucking great show.
So a couple of initial other thoughts as well. The score, that eerie bloody theme, is done by one of our old sort of favourites, one of my favourites, Jerry Goldsmith. And I believe it's his only Oscar win. For one of his probably least hummable scores.
Yeah, it's weird because I was sitting there thinking, because I haven't done it yet, I need to get the theme tune for the opening of the episode. And for the life of me, I couldn't even think what it was.
It's really heavy sort of orchestral. Or choir, and it really gets under your skin, actually. So we've talked about the cast a little bit. So we should jump into that a bit, I suppose. And what are your thoughts on some of the cast?
Fucking brilliant.
Yeah, the whole doctor of it. And that's why I think I have seen this film before. Because I have vivid memories of that death scene.
Yeah.
Which one? David Warner's or?
No. Patrick Troughton's.
Yeah,
I have vivid memories of that. And there's a few things that I don't think I've seen this probably for maybe 15 years.
So it wasn't a rewatch for you. You've seen this yourself. So, okay.
Yeah. So it's strange because there are, and there's certain locations as well that we'll come to in a bit. But
I was scribbling a note about that. So that was
interesting. I'm like, no, I definitely remember seeing this footage. So I definitely feel like I've seen it.
Yeah. But that is brutal, actually, isn't it? That the way they do it. Tracking it was great in it, I think. He's so twitchy, isn't he, throughout?
Yeah, very much. You can see there's definitely the hints of the Doctor in there.
Yeah,
he was like very much like that.
He's one of the best character actors this country has ever produced, in my opinion.
Yeah. And doesn't get the credit for it.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Because as horrible as it sounds, and to be honest, it's something that just comes with the job, no matter when you're cast as that character. But the second you're cast as the Doctor, obviously they wouldn't have known this back then, but you are the Doctor.
Yeah.
And you will be for the rest of your life.
And I think it was even more so back then, because they carried on playing the character even after they'd left. Like they do stage shows and things like that. And Troughton certainly did.
There was a stage, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Three times it gave up to John Wick. He always said, I'm doing 3 years, that's it, because I don't want to be typecast. So, sorry, mate, but you know, it's happened. Second you said yes, it had happened. But the thing, I've got to mention the scene between him and Gregory Peck in the park, because the reason that I watched this film for the very first time is because I was, for my 10th birthday, I was taken to London by my mum and dad, and we stayed in Putney Bridge. And just over the road from the Premier Inn was the bridge itself. And if you crossed over the road on the bridge and walked down a little side thing, you came across like a bank on the Thames. And we were just walking along there one night after we'd been for some food, and my dad just turned to my mum and said, I'm expecting Patrick Troughton to be sat on a bench up there. And I looked at my dad and said, who's Patrick Troughton? Because by this point, I wasn't really into Class of Who, at least. When we get home, like, film, and I'll lay, you'll understand. And like, 5 years later, he showed me the old, and I think it was the version that we've watched this episode, and I was like, yeah, I get it now, because by that point, I've got into Class as well.
So I think he was great bit of casting, wasn't he, having there, and he did have some great moments. Similarly as well, Warner is a really interesting character and performance in it. And that little plot, the photos that he takes is so really creepy, isn't it?
Oh, it's brilliant.
It's a strange one as well with him, because to start with, you don't think much of the character, do you? And then as the film goes on, he gets a much bigger role.
Yeah.
And then you get that reveal in the mirror of his own fate. And, oh, shit.
Yeah. It's a cracking little plot device, though, that Canva.
It's all set up their fate. And his fate, when it does come, it's absolutely shocking, isn't it?
Oh, grim.
Yeah. He's had that. And watching it back now, that fake head, it still holds up quite well. You consider it's a 1976 movie.
The only thing I'd say in its that's bad about it is the blood itself. Because it's that kind of sort of classic 70s, 80s blood, in that it's so obvious, just red paint, because it's so light.
Yes.
It's better than the one me and Tony talked about the other week. when they basically used ribbons. Because that's what it looked like.
Yeah. It's the way they just paint it onto the fabric and it just sort of blended the fabric. So it's all... Yes, we discovered Paul's not keen on certain sort of blood uses in films. But also, you'd imagine it would be quite much more messy as well.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah.
Dirty would just everywhere. But yeah, so when it comes, it's brutal, really. Because you'd also add as well a nice sort of cameo, Leo McKern, just before that. I mean, the film is just chock full of Brits. You got Billy Whitelaw. You really want to punch that nanny, don't you, when she's...
Chacal. I mean, I know she quite literally is a demon, but do you know what she reminds me of? You know, if Julie Walters and Satan had a child. Not Julie Walters, Julie Andrews.
Yeah.
She's literally just like evil Mary Poppins.
Mm. But she's so good in it. It's a really good film. And the leads, of course, because it's an American production and American money in there, you've got to have two sort of profile Americans in there. I thought they do it good. I think it's really interesting to see Peck, actually, because for me, the film kind of feels, and Josh might understand this a little bit, it feels like what a 70s Hammer would have been like with some money, basically.
Yeah.
Because Hammer's 70s films were getting really ropey, if you've ever seen any of them.
Yeah, no, I have seen the old ones, yeah.
And the modern ones were really ropey. And you just imagine if they'd have had this sort of budget, this is the sort of film they might have been able to knock out in the 70s. Because it's a very British feel, because it's set here, and it's, as Paul's mentioned, in the location. And of course, then we have to have those Americans in there just for that market. But I think they do a decent job. Lee Remick was no stranger in the 70s to doing these sort of genre films, because she was also, I believe, in the Medusa Touch as the psychiatrist. And then, of course, Peck himself was in Boys from the Brazil a couple of years later. So they both sort of dipped their toes into sort of genre films in the 70s. And credit to him for doing so, I think, as well. Because Peck had a great career up to that point. You think of things like To Kill a Mockingbird. Such different roles to what he's doing in this.
Yeah, because to me, Gregory Peck was always one of them actors that were mentioned by, like, me nan.
Like, guys from Navarone and all that stuff, and
I don't mean that in an offensive way at all, because the man can act evidently. But it was always one of them actors that would like when you sat around the table and you start discussing like really old films that the younger kids of the family have now started watching, and they go, "Oh, there was this fella who played this role," and like your nan will instantly go, "Oh my god, Gregory Peck absolutely loved him when I was younger," and. But they're always those actors that your nan will know the name of, but can't remember the face. But you'll know the face of, but don't know the name. And Gregory Peck was always one of them.
Yeah. And they I know, because this is a big thing I mean, Paul, about in our other podcast. And there's a good chemistry between them. You buy them as a husband and wife.
And
interesting, because he comes across as a slight, because he looks quite a bit older. I'm not sure what age he was, but I thought that's an interesting little element, whether it was deliberate or not, for him to be a slightly older father, and whether that's how much more important it was for him to have this kid.
Yeah.
As well.
I mean, to be honest, throughout this entire watch, I was sat there going, how the hell has he pulled it? Because, she's a fit little one, eh, you know?
She was very, very attractive, only room, yeah. But, Harvey's the little kid, he's just really creepy.
Oh, little bastard, him.
Yeah, it's just that, those little smirks he gives him. But I think that's the main cast. I think that really springs to mind. There's one or two sort of them, maybe. What else do we think? The set pieces, I suppose we should have just a little bit of chat about, and the deaths themselves and what your thoughts were on some of those.
Yeah, it was strange because the first kill is quite a nice way to kill, I think. I think it's a nice settling in to the film as it gets more and more violent.
Mm. Yeah, because it's a suicide as well. They just shrug it off, don't they? And it's sort of...
Yeah. And then obviously you get, as we've said, there's a few things like pick up. There's quite a few scenes that set things up for deaths. Yes. I suppose we better bring it up now. The scene at the safari park. it's ridiculous because I went there as a kid.
Yeah.
And
which one was that?
It was Windsor. Yeah. Which is now Legoland, which I've been to multiple times now. And it's really strange to think back that's how it was. And weirdly, watched the video because they've just announced they're building a new roller coaster there. And the big house that you see, you can't see it anymore. It's still there. But they covered it up. With like a ride entrance built in, so you can't get to it anymore. But this video brought it up because the new roller coaster is going in where the ride used to be that's in front of it. And it brought it up, and I sat there and I thought, you know, I've completely forgotten that was there. And then I went, but they showed it in The Omen, so how did I forget that? it's really weird to see that. And I said that the scene with the baboons is really freaky.
Yes,
because
they
are scary at times. You wouldn't want to mess with them, that's for sure.
And the irony is, they're kind of the good guys, really, in that scene.
Yeah.
And the thing that like really made me, I don't want to say laugh, but it did make me like smirk a bit, is that basically Damien looks out the window at them and smirks at them, and they obviously can see him in like a true devilish form or something like that.
Yeah, they got that extra sense in there or something.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And then, so they basically shit themselves and run away. But what makes me giggle a bit is that they basically all band together and go, no, go on, lads, we can take them. There's loads of us. There's only two of them in that car. And then they all go, eat shit.
Yeah.
And then there's actually another scene afterwards where they show Windsor Castle in the distance. I've played cricket on that field.
Oh, bloody hell. Brilliant.
Couldn't believe it when I saw it. I was like, yeah, I play cricket there.
Well, I guess we should just talk about these two together because they're kind of tied together, really, because the set pieces stroke deaths kind of tie in with the locations a bit, because I think that church where Troughton gets killed is down by the Thames, isn't it, somewhere, I think?
Yeah.
I kind of can't fancy going to do a locations tour of all these now. Other than Legoland, maybe.
It'll all be on IMDb.
So, because the other one, of course, we talk again because they do tie together, is the set piece where they go to the wedding, and Damien just loses it in the car, and I'm just sitting thinking, just drag his little ass in there and just watch him melt.
From Good Omens, where David Tennant walks into the church to save Michael Sheen, and he's like tiptoeing everywhere because it's so hot, because he shouldn't be in there because he's a demon.
Because that's Guildford, isn't it, Paul? I think they filmed that.
Yeah, I believe so. I'm just literally looking at see whether they have got locations.
IMDb,
because normally they do.
Every time I watch it, I'm trying to analyse the road signs that they drive past.
It's Guildford Cathedral.
It's Guildford, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a sign for Peterborough, isn't there, or something on the one, right? And landed in the other direction. And I had to look it up in the end. It's bugging me every time I watch this film where that is. But it's a really impressive cathedral, though. It's sat on its own on the hill, isn't it?
It's friggin' massive.
It's very gothic. I mean, it's very. In fact, the location scouting on this film is incredible.
It's Richard Donner. You can't put the man down for nearly anything, can you? I haven't really looked at this, but did he do this before or after Superman?
Richard Donner. This was 76, so he probably went from this. It's two Superman. It's kind of 2 years for films for a director, roughly, isn't it?
Yeah, I would imagine
he's just come off this and he gets the call from the Salt Guys and they go, we've just seen your Omen film. Do you want to come and do Superman? And he's like, are you kidding me?
Yes, he must have gone from this because this came out in 76. So he probably shot 75, 76. And then on to because Superman came out in 78.
Yeah. So he would have gone from one to the next.
From this is Fox over to Warner Brothers to shoot that. Bloody hell, that's a back-to-back CP, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's two big projects on your plate within like 3 years. Bloody hell. I suppose we should talk about Donner briefly as well. That's kind of why he's always been one of my favourite directors, just because his CV was so eclectic, such a mixture of stuff on there.
Yeah. I think he's one of them directors that's never really made a bad film.
No, he made what I would call very good quality popcorn films. He never really was going to bother the Academy too much.
Yeah.
But what he made was really strong popcorn films that have got a good story and good characters.
And I think that's the best spot to be in.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
Honestly. I don't think you'd want anything more than that.
Yeah.
If I were a film director, I would much rather be remembered for not having awards and being like actually entertaining people who've sat down and watched my films than people going, oh, do you remember him as a director? He won 15 Oscars for like all out of all the 20 films he made. He won this, he won that. No, if I get asses on seats and get them like munching on the popcorn and they come out and go, that was a fucking great film, that's going to be remembered till the end of time. I'd rather that.
You look at that CV. You've got this. You've got Superman, and originally Superman 2 to some extent. You've got the Lethal Weapon films. You did all four of them. That's very rare as well for a director to make all the films in the set.
Yeah.
What else? Something. Scrooged, of course, is another one. The bloke just could make really good, strong, entertaining films with characters you care about and plots that engage you. And he kind of on a 3 out of 5 rating. Most of his Duff films were nothing more less than a 3 out of 5.
Yeah,
and so sometimes
that's what I mean. He's
five.
Never really made a proper like stinker.
No,
which is something not a lot of directors can say.
No. I say that's why he remains one of my favorite directors. He's just such a good. In fact, I own as many of his films as anybody else's. I suspect.
And then you got to think about what he did afterwards as a producer as well. I don't think we'd have, on top of him doing Superman, I don't think the superhero genre would be the same if it wasn't for his X-Men films.
Yes, because we all forget he was a co-producer on those. I was shocked the first I went back and rewatched them recently, and I totally forgot that he was involved.
Yeah,
see, and his production company pop up on there,
and his wife still is right until the last minute. She was,
yeah. I said we touched on Jerry is a little bit, and I think it's amazing that the only Oscar he's ever won was for this, for a sort of 1970s horror film with a really sort of gets on your skin score. But there you go. Some creators don't get the awards that they deserve sometimes, do they? So there we go. I just think, is there any other highlights that you guys want to mention? Things I've just sort of off the top of my head that just stand out. The egg chasing sequence, where we've got a rugby match in the middle of the film.
Yeah.
For Triton. And I always amuse me to see rugby matches in it, or football matches in the middle of an American movie like that. It's just,
yeah.
The ones are set in Britain anyway. This is like, what can we find that's quintessentially British to pop in the middle of the film?
Considering what Americans think of us and like how sort of quaint we apparently are, I'm surprised they didn't put cricket in and get Paul on the pitch.
Not that old. I was minus eight when this came out.
Minus eight.
So all right, Paul's bowling as a spam self, whatever.
I'm just going to look at some of my random little notes of little things I picked up. And there's one. Oh, yes, there's one sequence. I think it might have been in the hospital where they're paging a Dr. Jones, and they didn't just make me smile. I think we just done him.
Yeah, and of course, the doctor is also known as Dr. Jones.
Yes.
At times as well.
Is he?
Yeah. That's why the whole thing is Martha Jones.
Oh, you're thinking John Smith?
Yeah.
Ah, right, okay. Not sure what is she? I'll tell you what I'd want to bring up. Fucking dog.
Oh, well, yes, he's another great character, wouldn't he? He's nasty.
Little hellhound, quite literally.
Yeah.
There's one particular scene I would like to bring up, and it's in the graveyard. That entire sequence, I would say, plot-wise and just in terms of acting from Warner and Peck, is absolutely fantastic.
Oh, yes, it's a fantastic sequence, isn't it? And the set design, because I don't think that's a location. I think that's a set.
Yeah, that's a set. You could tell from the background, but no, I'd have to say it's just even the reveal of the child's skeleton.
Mm.
That is, I didn't think they'd go that far, because I thought it would be like an upshot, as in like the camera's looking up at Peck and Warner, and you don't actually see the kid's skeleton with its egg caved in. I thought
the first time I saw this film. It's probably on late night telly, and that just freaked me out, that sequence and that scene.
It's that, like, reveal. I mean, the thing with the dog I got, because obviously it's, you know, child of Satan, born of a hellhound, but like the thing with the baby in the crypt with a smashed in skull, that was absolutely disgusting. I mean, in fairness, it's brilliant for effect in the plot, but I really didn't expect them to show it.
Yeah. Well, in a sort of tied to that, when you look back over the film and the events of that, those 5 years previously, the people that were involved, like two priests that were basically bad, was Triton's basically going through some sort of redemptive arc, because he says he was there that night, wasn't he? And also the other father that got burnt in the fire. And you bastards, what drove you to take that other path, you know?
Yeah, because that's kind of why I like the Good Omens version of how the Antichrist comes into the world, in that they don't like swap the kids out and kill one of them. They literally just swap them.
Mm. Yes.
I prefer that version.
Well, yeah.
Because at least the child gets to live.
Yeah, they could easily just dump the ambassador's kid with some poor family or whatever and let him live that a poor life. Yeah. But it is a freaky to see that jackal skeleton in there.
Oh my, yeah.
Thinking about it now.
the bit that I wanted to bring up is kind of the, is she dead or isn't she dead with his mum throughout the back half of the film? Because you really think she is dead to start with.
Well, that tricycle build-up and that fall is brutal.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
How she survived that in the first place?
Yeah, and then to go and actually kill her off about 20 minutes later.
Yeah.
After all she's already been through. Yeah.
Because the thing is, Troughton prophesizes that the mum's pregnant and Damon will kill the child and then her. So it kind of makes you think, oh, he's doing a two in one.
Yeah.
But then obviously she survives. So you're like, oh, right. So she is going to die later on then.
Yeah. But yeah, she does get a rough ride in that film, and she fair do. And he just. When he's right around that tree, I just want them two sisters from The Shining to pop up.
It's like, have a race down the corridor.
Come play with us, Damien.
He should have fucking gone with them, then they'd have killed him off and he wouldn't have hurt anyone. Little bastard.
Yeah. But yeah, just starting across the relationship he has with the nanny as well. Oh, just woman. The way she like casually says that they've just. Basically, she's just told the governess housekeeper to fuck off, and she said, she left. No, missus, you got rid of her somehow. You told her to piss off, didn't you?
Do you know something that's always puzzled me with this film, right? Well, the plot of the film, not this one in particular, is does Damien sort of get the realization that he is the Antichrist when the Hellhound turns up at his birthday? Or has he always known since the second the Jackal gave birth to him?
No, I don't think even then. I don't think it's really has any inkling until the new nanny comes along.
Oh, right. So you think she tells him his heritage then?
I think so, or sort of in some sort of way that like a five-year-old would understand. Because when we get to in a couple of months' time, it's in the second one, he's very much more aware of who he is and he's standing in the world.
Yeah.
In those intervening years, we'll talk about the weird timelines as well at that point probably. But I took it that it's kind of not really until she comes along and sort of just pushes him in that direction.
Because the thing that makes me wonder, was it at his birthday? Is because once the old nanny has hung herself from the roof, he then sees the hellhound in the bushes and waves at it. So I'm wondering whether it's like, he makes eye contact with it and all the knowledge is downloaded, if that makes sense.
I swear there might be just that sort of five-year-old curiosity.
Waving at the dog, yeah.
Yeah, and sort of, you know, like kids of that age, that they're pleased by different things, aren't they? And sort of, so you might just see it as a nice big doggy. but you can't really, it doesn't really tell you, and I think it's probably a good thing. There's an element of him just being a five-year-old kid who's sort of seen all this wondrous stuff going on around him. And I think until the nanny sort of starts to sort of effectively kind of coach him when she's got that bloody door shut.
Yeah.
But even then, I don't think he's really, it's him particularly willing things to happen.
Yeah.
It's his other dad looking out for him, probably. that's how I was in it anyway.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. I just took a massive gulp of water and like near choked myself. So, because I've had all them cornflakes now. I mean, I've got a throat like Gandhi's flip flop.
Yeah. We haven't touched on, we should mention it in sort of the one bit of the climax as things sort of ramp up. When Peck takes the scissors to his hair and finds the magic number, that's such a weird scene, I think.
It's really strange. Yeah, it's really strange because the shooting style changes.
Yeah.
In that scene. It's very strange. It makes you feel out of place.
And there's a real zoom close-up on it, isn't there? It sort of just really lingers on it and sort of just hammers the point home. You kind of wanted to shave his head at that point as well. he really was a little shit. Wasn't he? But that's a sort of, it is a great little scene though, and that realization that from Pex that his kid's basically Antichrist, and even at that point you think, is he really going to do it? Is he going to kill him? And even when they get him into the church, he's still not sure whether that's going to happen, though.
Yeah, it's the fact that he asks for forgiveness at the same time. That's what that's what does it for me. I'm like, oh, he's definitely going to go through this. But
and then Dane gives him the daddy.
I know.
Trixie Git. Oh, and it's actually really sort of tragic what happens to those two. I mean, they got him and his missus. He gets shot on the altar, of course. It's sort of...
They are but sacrificial pawns in the game of religion.
Yeah, it's really unfair. What happens to them. They just... They just wanted a nice, happy family, and then they ended up getting the bloody spawn of the devil. Like you do.
I think a few parents on this planet might say that about their own children sometimes.
probably some said it about us over the years.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, of course, Jerry scores very much up front as well in those last final moments.
Yeah.
The piano bit, because we don't think of him as doing much piano.
No.
But there's a lot of piano sort of underlays in this one. I think probably that's probably exhausted all the key points of the film now. I suppose we ought to think about some sort of summaries of the film and your experiences with it, and some scores.
Paul? Yeah, I'm happy to go. Yeah. I was saying to Josh before we started, I didn't actually finish my notes. I got to the end and I think I got disturbed. But yeah, I'd written down that it has a real good mystery feel to it. It doesn't just feel like it's a horror. Like there's some horrific moments, and obviously the general side of it is it's a horror film because it's about the devil and stuff like that. But it has some real great build up.
We follow the investigation alongside the father, don't we? That's quite nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the thrill and elements of it, yeah.
Yeah, it never really becomes a full-on horror. You've got that. It builds up to kind of the end when it's revealed to everybody what he is.
More that psychological horror, doesn't it, for the most part?
Yeah, it's like definitely.
Three flashes of violence, but the rest of it just gets under your skin.
Yeah, really, and you get, as I said, those moments with his mom when you think, is she or isn't she? And it's a real good mystery vibe to it at times, and yeah, I enjoyed it. Sometimes I can find horror a little bit too, and this is coming from someone that loves things like Halloween Horror Nights and just your general horror events. But when it comes to film, sometimes I find it a little bit blasé at times about it, because there's a lot of them that have got similar tropes and stuff like that that just I struggle to sit and watch sometimes. But this I really enjoyed. Not saying it's a world's greatest film, but I'd still say I'd watch it again.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what we were saying earlier, but a lot of that is down to Donner and also getting writers on board with him. You've got to have interesting characters you care about.
Yeah.
And a good, interesting plot to follow. And a lot of modern horror just abandons both of them in the search for cheap jump scares and gore.
Definitely. Score, I would probably give it a 74.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. And as I said, I'd go and watch it again, but it's not something I'd put in my top 20 or 30 films I've ever seen.
It's not a first time rewatch for me, as you said, but yeah, I to be honest, I actually watch this film about once a year, because I always do the 31 Days of Horror with Dad, and The Omen is always on the list as a film to be watched. It won't be this year because I've already watched it. Paul. Thanks for that, Tony. No, it's a brilliant film. As you say, it's the characters that drive it. The plot is well thought out. It's exactly what you want from a horror film, and it's not particularly like your typical slasher, jump scare, haunted house, cabin in the woods type thing. It's brilliant. It's definitely up there in terms of my top 20 horror thriller films. Like Paul said, probably might only break in the top 75 of my favourite films. But score-wise, I go higher than Paul, just sheer because it's a classic. I'd go about 78.
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, neither of you kind of far out from mine. I say for me, this film is one I sort of discovered on telly late one night, and it just sort of drew me in, and kind of revisited a couple of times over the years. Picked up the Blu-ray set when I could. Really enjoyed this rewatch of it. I say the Donner's direction is fantastic. He makes such good quality entertainment. The atmosphere is just so unnervy all the time. The score just gets to you as well. It's great seeing it in London as well and around London. And always nice to see a horror film set here. yes, score-wise for me, I'm probably going to just go a little bit higher than you two just because it's kind of one of my, like you say, probably not my top 10, but it's one of my top horrors. And for me, I probably would give it a 82%.
Oh, right. Okay. Hi.
Just slightly higher than you, just knocking it up into the 4 out of 5 category, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. The thing that will be interesting is when we then compare it to the remake.
To the remake. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And the thing that will be then interesting after that, for me at least, is watching 2 and 3 because I've never ever seen them.
Well, that will be interesting because I've seen them, and the law of diminishing returns does take effect by the third one. Let's put it like that.
All right.
The second one has its moments, and there's a couple of great scenes that you'll see in there. And the third one, we shall see how you react to that. But yes, I've only seen the remake myself once, so that'll be interesting to go back to that next month. See that. I saw at this point, I'll just jump over to Paul because he has the list of socials that you can get us on.
Yeah. If you want to find us on social media, we're everywhere under BPB Podcast Productions. You can also leave us reviews on your podcast app of choice. That helps us greatly.
Yep. Cool. Right. Well, on that note, I should say thank you, gents, for joining us tonight. And thank you, listeners. And we will be back with the not at all made just because of the date it was released remake. Good night.